This installment of the KunzerCast is brought to you by Grinning Planet, providing real news in a free weekly MP3 format. Grinning Planet compiles the best audio news coverage of the week on a single page to save you time and cut through the mainstream propaganda. Hear stories like the Unified Inflation Deflation Theory, Our Future Hinges on Peak Oil, and Crime of the Century, The Bankster's Coup d'Etat. To start listening today, go to grinningplanet.com and click on News Download. That's grinningplanet.com.
I lived the lies all my life, and I've been living here for a long, long time. And I know it's been coming down a while now.
Hey everyone, it's Duncan Crary. You're listening to the KunzerCast. Each week on this show, I speak with James Howard Kunstler about a variety of topics under the theme of the tragic comedy of suburban sprawl. We also speak about urbanism and energy issues as well. Jim is the author of The Geography of Nowhere, The Long Emergency, and World Made by Hand. The topic of today's show is Boston, Massachusetts. Hey, Jim, we're on like a tour of American cities this month, right? We've talked about New York City, and now we're going to talk about Boston. You were recently in Boston, right?
Yeah, I was there last week.
You lived in Boston for a while, and you were recently back there, so are you having some kind of Boston now and then thoughts about the place?
Yeah, I was sort of having Boston now and then nostalgic thoughts. I went there in 1972. It was the year after I got out of college, and I was sort of at loose ends, as many young men are at that time in their life. And my stepfather knew a guy who was the publisher of a hippie newspaper that was called Boston After Dark. Mm. And he said, if I went to Boston, maybe I could write for these guys, because, you know, I had done some writing in college.
Yeah.
So I rode the dog to Boston and went to the offices of this place, and they started throwing me little assignments, you know, $5 record reviews and stuff like that. And within a short period of time, I was writing feature stories. But it was really a tough time, and it was a tough gig. And Boston of 1972 was really a far cry from what it is today. It had, you know, it was coming out of a long period of kind of economic malaise. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you got a feeling from being there that its time had passed in many ways, and that it wasn't clear where it was going in the future. You know, as it happened, not long after that, it became kind of the East Coast capital of the computer industry, you know, with digital computers and a lot of software companies out on Route 128, the ring road that goes around Boston. But when I was there, it was still pretty kind of sad, gothic kind of old place full of, you know, Cambridge, where I lived for about half the time I was there, was this really dark old gothic place full of old Bible factories and dictionary factories. And whenever I went into the office of the newspaper, I'd go past the New England Confectionery Company, where they made Necco wafers, and all these big, dreary old buildings. And
I love Necco wafers, by the way.
Who doesn't like Necco wafers?
A lot of people don't. They say they taste like chalk. I mean, my friends make fun of me because they're chalky.
But yeah, they give you a lot of them. You know, you can always say that for the damn things.
So cool. They made Necco wafers there.
Yeah. And there were parts of the city which are now completely gentrified, which then were really scary. I remember, you know, through one period of desperation, I had to get some side work, and somebody turned me on to the substitute teaching racket, where, you know, you go and you sign up to be a substitute teacher, and they call you every once in a while, and you go there, and, you know, you can pick up like a $40 a day paycheck for doing it. Now, I really needed the dough. So as a part of that, I had to go down and have a tuberculosis test at this hospital in the South End.
Yeah.
The South End at that time was just the dreariest neighborhood you can imagine of, you know, mid-19th century houses that had fallen apart that nobody had fixed up for decades. And the hospital I went to was like the kind of place that the Elephant Man would have gone to, you know. It was everything, you know, I just have this memory of the place being just so dark and dreary and sort of falling apart.
Did it have the kind of spray paint graffiti that New York City?
No. Actually, that was not part of the scene. But, you know, everything was just sort of in disrepair everywhere. And I lived in this dreary apartment on Highland Avenue, actually in Somerville, which is one neighborhood beyond Cambridge. And I lived on this big ridge looking down on these strange lands across the Mystic River, you know, places like Revere, you know, just these beat up old New England towns and all the industry is leaving. The place was really kind of sad. But there are some nice things about it. One of them was you could get into a Red Sox game anytime you wanted to for like $6. Mm-hmm. Now it costs like $300 to buy a scalp ticket outside Fenway Park because they're sold out for every game for the in perpetuity, right? Back then, you could just walk up, you know, on the night of the game, you could just walk up to the ticket counter and buy a pretty decent box seat for $6. And, you know, so that was pretty groovy. I got into a weird kind of jag while I was there. You know, I had to make up my own assignments and scare up my own stories just to get published. I was just pursuing the weirdest characters. You know, I started interviewing guys who were mafia hitmen and transvestites and all kinds of lunatics. You know, there's this one couple I remember who had been walking up and down in front of the State House for 30 years with sandwich boards protesting the fact that their home had been confiscated by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to build a freeway. And they just never got over it. And so every day for the next 30 years, they went out in front of the state capitol building with these sandwich boards on and marched up and down. So, you know, these are the kinds of people I, you know, spend my time with writing about.
Yeah.
And scratching out a living, you know, as a journalist. Eventually, I moved from Somerville down into the center of Cambridge. And I found a pretty nice apartment in a pre-war 5-story red brick apartment building. It was pretty nice, actually. It had a lobby and everything. It cost me about $100 a month, you know, and now it must be a $600,000 condominium because the real estate values in Cambridge just went out of sight after I left. After the 1970s, you know, things really picked up in Boston again, and the computer industry started to ramp up, and even the beginnings of biotech and stuff, and it became a pretty ritzy place. You know, and a lot of these other neighborhoods like Brighton and the area around BU and the area around Boston College, and even the Back Bay was pretty seedy back then. And now you go back to these places and it's really kind of remarkable how, what good shape everything is in there, you know, pretty much. And what a wonderful shape the subway is and the T, as they call it. It's one of the few cities in America that you go to where you actually see happy people on public transit. You know, people who look like they're having a good time and they're laughing and they're young. A lot of young people because there are so many colleges there. The transformation from this dark, gothic, kind of unhappy, miserable, burnt out town to being now, a pretty vibrant, youthful, well taken care of, gentrified place. And people complain about gentrification constantly, but it's really hard to see that it's been anything but really a good thing for a city like Boston. And, you know, the argument is that people who have money should not go into urban neighborhoods and fix them up and clean them up and fix up the property because in some way it deprives poor people of being able to inhabit the city. But if you don't have people in the city who are well off, who can take care of the city, you know, to be the caretakers of the city, who are you going to depend on to do that? So it's very important that people who have money, middle class people, should be welcomed into the city. And they should be welcome to fixing up urban property, not discouraged from doing it. And, you know, the process in Boston, all in all, has worked out pretty well, I think.
I have a slightly different take on Boston. I lived there for 3 months, I don't know, years ago. I was taking a class at Boston College, and I was really struck by how expensive things were. But I was a college kid, so if I went back there today, probably still hit me pretty hard with the money I make. But it was kind of expensive.
Yeah, well, you know, when I look back on it, it just seems incredible to me that I was able to have a pretty nice apartment one block away from Harvard Square, you know, for about $100 a month.
Right.
You know, I don't know what kind of society that was back then. It didn't seem a whole lot different from where we're at now. You know, we still speak English and we still drive in cars and, you know, we still, you know, chew bazooka bubblegum, but it was a different society. You know, things have really changed now.
Many things at the time in Boston seemed like they were, I was locked out of them because of the money thing. I couldn't really participate in the scene.
There's an institution in Boston called the Museum of Fine Arts. Mm-hmm. It's a big art museum, and it's a pretty good one by American standards. You know, they got a lot of cool stuff in there.
Yeah.
The main part of the museum, of course, is the, you know, the Beaux-Arts building from the, you know, the turn of the 20th century, 100 years ago. Naturally, it's a, you know, it's one of those big, grand Greco-Roman buildings, right? Well, the front entrance was closed for years and years and years, the front entrance on Huntington Avenue. And they had built this new wing off to the side, designed by I.M. Pei, which became the new entrance. And it was really, you know, it was this very, very stark, modern, not really ornamented or embellished wall that you pass through to get into the new I.M. Pei lobby. And I guess finally, you know, after 30, 40 years, people decided, you know, enough is enough. We're going to reopen the grand entrance on Huntington Avenue.
Yeah,
and now you can go through it. And it really makes a difference.
This is what gets me in trouble. But I sometimes feel like the people of Boston have a chip on their shoulder with New York City. Like they're the kid brother of New York City and they don't want to be treated like the kid brother. Am I already in trouble, Jim?
I never really got that feeling. I do get a different feeling from being in Cambridge, which is that you got a feeling from being around in the orbit of Harvard and MIT. And I was just there by happenstance, you know, because I happened to have an apartment there and I was being a hippie newspaper reporter. But you got the feeling that it was a very deeply unhappy place, full of deeply unhappy people who, despite all of the status conferred by these institutions, were not having a very happy college life. And that it was, you know, it was abnormally, they were abnormally put upon in this time in their life. And, you know, it seemed like a miserable place.
Well, what interests me, this relationship between Boston and New York, and I'm anthropomorphizing it, I guess, is that New York is referred to, at least by New Yorkers, as the city. The city. And, of course, we know there are many other cities throughout the country, and they come in all different shapes and sizes. But in many of our minds, New York City is the model for a city, and it's the only city. And, of course, Boston is a big city. It's an expensive big city, and but it's not New York.
Right. Well, and it isn't quite as cosmopolitan as New York, but there's, you know, there's plenty of good stuff there, and there are plenty of smart people there, and plenty of people who are doing well there, and a lot of activities that that are successful. It's got quite a bit of character of its own, and it's got beautiful neighborhoods, and very distinctly beautiful neighborhoods. I guess one of the oddest things about the whole region to me is the whole thing about MIT. You know, MIT is the great school at the other end of Massachusetts Avenue in Cambridge. And, you know, Harvard's at one end, MIT's at the other end. And MIT has got to be the ugliest academic neighborhood in America. You know, and I don't, you know, we were kind of debating this while we were there. Is it because science-oriented people or engineer types have no interest whatsoever in their surroundings? You know, you couldn't have devised an uglier campus if you invited the devil to run the design team. And everything they've done lately, even these new Frank Gehry buildings and Stephen Hall buildings and, you know, Starkitect buildings, have done nothing to make it any better.
But that's something I want to talk to you about on a later show. The whole topic is just about college architecture. Uh-huh. Because, okay, MIT might be really bad.
Well,
but
the reason I mention it is because we did a lot of walking. And on this one day, we walked up and down Newbury Street in the Back Bay all the way to the Public Garden and back. And then we walked down Massachusetts Avenue across the Charles River, across the bridge into Cambridge, where MIT starts. And it's just, you know, you're struck when you get to the MIT stretch of Mass Avenue at how dreary and dismal that part of Mass Avenue is and how unnecessary it is for it to be dismal. And you wonder, you know, what is the excuse for that, or what is the cause of that?
Science nerds is what you're thinking of.
I guess, you know.
I don't know.
They just don't give a shit.
In my experience, I mean, RPI is another technical school here in Troy, and I've talked to some of the students. They think that a lot of the new buildings are all ugly, and they're science nerds, so
yeah.
I don't know if that's necessarily the cause of it. I think it has there's something else going on in college. It's the status competition to build these wacky buildings. Mm-hmm. There's a new one at Skidmore in your neck of the woods, a new building that's pretty ridiculous looking.
It's going to be next month's eyesore of the month, well, the Zankel Music Center.
Okay, so Jim, everyone's heard of, everyone's seen Cheers, and everyone's heard of the Big Dig when they think of Boston, so let's hear your take on the Big Dig. Have you inspected any of the areas?
Yeah, I did. I went down to the Quincy Market area, which is right next to where the Fitzgerald Expressway used to run. And the Fitzgerald Expressway, which I guess was I-95, was an elevated freeway that traversed the old north end of town, you know, the Paul Revere neighborhood of town, the great historic area. And over the 20th century, most of the north end had become a very solid Italian neighborhood. It was still very beautiful, full of old windy streets that were kind of, you know, quasi-medieval and very intimate spaces and lovely little squares and relatively small buildings. But it was all cut off from the rest of the older parts of Boston by this expressway, including the West End and what became the Government Center and the Financial District and the area around the State House. So the Fitzgerald Expressway was like the Great Wall of China, separating the old North End from the rest of Boston, and they decided to get rid of it and knock it down and reroute the roadway underneath the city and then connect it to, you know, through a tunnel to the airport. And this all went on in the 90s. It ended up costing something like $15 billion or more to bury the expressway. It was known as the Big Dig. And now it's done. And the interesting thing for me is, you know, what happened on the surface. The outcome of the Big Dig on the surface of the street level ended up being really surprisingly peculiar, because they had reclaimed something like, I don't know, maybe 20-odd acres altogether in land that could now be built on, or that you could do something with, you know, that was where the freeway used to be, and now it's just sort of a strip of land. And what developed was kind of a pissing match between the environmental community and the urban design community, such as it is. And the environmentalists basically won out. And the idea was going to be that this reclaimed land would all be, quote, green space. And what it's turned out to be is an extremely nebulous parcel of property now that doesn't seem to really have much purpose except to be, in fact, you could say that it's just another barrier between the old North End and the other old part of town. It seems to me it would have been much more intelligent to turn it into a continuation of the street and block fabric between these two neighborhoods, and to build on some of it and maybe reserve some of it for little civic squares. But you didn't have to save it all. You know, you didn't have to save all 20 acres and turn it into green space. But what it shows, I think, is our total lack of confidence in our ability to put buildings up that would be worth living with. You know, so that we always default to this idea that, well, you know, we're no good at doing the buildings, or the starchitects are just going to come in and put up something awful. So let's just declare this a nature zone and, you know, create something like a half-ass park. And that's kind of what they ended up doing, unfortunately.
Yeah, people underestimate how dreary a half-ass park can actually be.
Yeah.
And I was just, there's a little tiny pocket park in front of the college down the street from me. There's a small all-women's college down the street from me. But there's a little pocket park in front of the school, and I was walking through it the other day and thinking, like, the greatest thing about this is the man-made structures, the attractive benches, the attractive lighting, the cast iron fence that defines the space.
Yeah.
You know, the trees and the grass are okay, but it's those man-made elements that, when they're done with artistry, are the most pleasant things about parks. And these half-assed parks don't have that. They just
You put that pretty nicely, and I think that's precisely the difference between a park and a green space. A green space is just an abstraction, and it's just somebody's abstract notion of whatever non-city fabric is, you know, non-urban fabric. And, you know, the bottom line is they couldn't bring themselves to replace the urban fabric that at some point in history had yielded to the freeway. And we haven't reached a point yet in our culture where we can build it back with confidence. So right now, this reclaimed land that they went to such expense to get is really serving very little purpose at all.
Yeah. Jim, another thing that interests me about Boston, and I know very little about, is that, you know, Boston is a big city and it's a state capital.
Hmm.
And a lot of state capitals are located in smaller cities outside of the big city.
The founding fathers and their successors who started to build the country up, you know, and after the revolution, had this idea that it would not be good to have the capital in the biggest city of your state, because then it would be corrupted by business and commercial interests and all these forces that would, you know, tend to put politicians in their pockets. So we kind of got into the habit of putting the state capitals in places where they would be nowhere near, you know, the guys with money.
Yeah. So why is Boston? Do you know why Boston is the state capital instead of Springfield, Massachusetts, or something? That would be like a small city in the center of the state, right?
I can only guess that it became the center of government for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts so long before the Revolution that it was pretty much a fait accompli. You know that. That, you know, it had been the capital for generations before the American Revolution, and there's just, you know, they weren't going to move it.
Right, and I'm sure somebody's written a book about this, so we could look that up. But so let me ask you something that you probably do know. Do you sense a different vibe in Boston because it's a state capital and a big city? Have you noticed that being the center of the state government in a big city changes what's going on? Or,
well, I can't really say that, although I have hung out in the state capital as a newspaper reporter, and just coming across the Charles River on the red line of the subway, it emerges from the tunnel on the far end up by MIT, and it comes out and crosses the river, and you get this incredible sweeping view of the golden dome of the state house. And, you know, when I used to live there and I saw that thing every morning, it was really a beautiful, stunning sight just to see that dome, you know. And I think it did exactly what the builders hoped it would do. You know, it kind of instilled in you a sense that this was the important golden center of something important.
Right.
You know, that there was something great about a democracy, and this was the physical artifact that stood for it. And it was meant to impress you that way, and it did. You know, I think for most of us who lived there, one didn't really get a sense of being in a political city, per se.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't sort of reek of politics, certainly not the way a place like Washington does. You know, it seems like one of the really smaller enterprises in town.
Yeah, that's what kind of interests me. And because here in Albany, you have the Capitol is this huge, oversized building.
Yeah, and then the thing that Nelson Rockefeller built, you know, the Empire State Plaza, which is the, basically where the bureaucrats all are.
Yeah, and it's huge and imposing, and it's the state in this tiny city.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have all these big politicians with huge egos, and some of them come from the big city in New York City, and they come up to the small city.
Well, the Boston State House is a much more modest building, you know, and it's integrated into the fabric of Beacon Hill, which is a beautiful neighborhood of winding streets. And the building itself on the other side overlooks Boston Common, which is the great park of the center of the old part of the city. And so, you know, it's a beautiful object. And you get a sense that, you know, important things do happen there, but it doesn't overwhelm the city the way, you know, the Empire State Plaza does here in New York.
Well, our state capitol building and all is beautiful, but our governmental complex is hideous, and I've seen that replicated in other state capitals.
Well, most of the capitals in the United States were built before World War I, so they're mostly huge, exuberant Greco-Roman heaps of one kind or another.
Mm. Okay, Jim, well, thanks for talking about Beantown with me.
Yeah, old Beantown.
My favorite little thing in Beantown is the little Makeway for Ducklings statue that they have
in the public garden.
Yeah.
And the swan boats.
Yeah.
Those are very winning things. There are a lot of very beautiful, sweet little winning things in Boston. I spent about a year there, all of 1972 in Boston, and I had a lot of very strange adventures there. But when all is said and done, I was kind of beat up by the experience, and I really needed to get out of there after that year, and I did. And I was glad to, and I embarked then on a long journey that took me to a lot of other cities and places and things. But it's always good to get back to Boston and find that, it's better than ever. And in many ways it is. And in many ways it's more healthy than, 90% of the other cities in America. It has thriving neighborhoods. The people who are doing okay in life live in the center of the city. It's not abandoned like Cleveland or Detroit or St. Louis or Kansas City, They're at the center of town. It's very, very active, and it's really good to see that in an American city. There are so few American cities, that can be described that way. I mean, you can really count them on one hand, San Francisco, New York City, Chicago, Boston, maybe Washington, D.C., and that's about it. The rest of them are dead. So it was a pleasure to go back there, and especially a pleasure to walk around on a fine fall weekend.
All right. Well, on that note, Jim, thanks a lot for talking with me.
Nice to be here.
Well, that's it for today's show. And before I leave you, I just want to give a special thanks to Mark at grinningplanet.com, not only for sponsoring this program during the last month, but for allowing me to bump his sponsorship spot by 1 week. So thank you, Mark. Everyone out there, please check out grinningplanet.com. You'll find all sorts of great audio, news, commentary, and little treats for your ears and your minds. You've been listening to the Kunstler Cast featuring James Howard Kunstler. To leave a listener comment, call toll-free at 866-924-9499. Send email to letters@kunstlercast.com. You can listen to all of our past programs, join our email list, find out how to book Jim to speak in your area, and talk about the show with other listeners at kunstlercast.com. I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Thanks for listening.